This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up later, we'll hear from a guest who says being around water is a key to making us healthier and happier. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Naturalist John Muir once wrote, "The clearest way into the universe is through a forest wilderness." Writer Ron Davis went looking for a favorite tree near his home and discovered stories in the bark.
A few weeks ago, a friend posted a photo online of his favorite tree, a magnificent sugar maple in his front yard, probably 5 feet around. In response, I posted one of my own favorites, and soon friends and family were doing likewise. It got me to thinking, does everybody have a favorite tree? I really hope so. On our little chunk of property in the township of Scandinavia, we have thousands of trees. When we first moved here, it was almost solid with 30 or 40-year-old aspen. Most were about 5 or 6 stories tall, only leafing out at the top since we live on the north side of a ridge. Our gloomy woods had little to no understory and scarce wildlife, other than an occasional family of whitetails wandering through, or a bunch of flying squirrels who liked the holes chiseled out by pileated woodpeckers. When a ferocious straight-line wind uprooted and sheared some of the aspens off 20 years ago, we had the land logged. What sprang up next was a cornucopia of species. Ash, red and white oak, birch, basswood, silver maple, a few cherry, and of course, more aspen. An army of wildlife also moved in to feast on the seedlings, buds, raspberries, hazelnuts. Now our little plot is once again solid with trees, making it hard to pick a favorite. It might just be the lonely, towering white pine that stands directly in front of our house. It's got to be almost 100 years old and is one of only a few ancients on the ridge that were left either for seed or because they weren't prime stock. Ours has a double trunk. The broad bottom branches of our pine used to fan out to the ground, making a cool, damp tent. My neighbor Roy told me when he was a boy he'd frequently be sent to fetch their blind cow from beneath its branches, the poor animal lurching around in endless circles. But my favorite could also be the scraggly paper birch in the fence row across the road. Over the years we've lived here, it has resolutely endured blizzards, ice storms, sieges of wild grape and leaf curl, the continual encroachment of the farmer's reach, and the yearly assaults from bucks sharpening up their antlers. We occasionally have a few grouse around, which you can sometimes see silhouetted in the birch's branches, probably hunting for its buds, or maybe, as the old-timers in the neighborhood contend, sitting out their hangovers from eating grapes fermented on the vine. I just can't help but admire that little tree's pluck. On the other hand, maybe it's the white oak I sit in every gun deer season. Sitting up there in November, I can scan 5 miles of snowy countryside, a patchwork quilt of harvested cornfields, woodlots, and swamp. Squirrels like that tree anyway, and will scurry up and down, keeping the trunk between us, sometimes peeking around to wonder at the curious creature shivering away, cloaked in blaze orange. We're tree-rich in Wisconsin. Millions upon billions of trees, each one a brave but silent testament to tenaciousness. Maybe by choosing favorites, our lives, as Shakespeare wrote, give them tongues. Tongues to tell their stories, as well as our own.
Ron Davis teaches English at the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. For more information, visit wisconsinlife.org. Well, every tree has a story, and joining us now to talk about some of our state's most cherished trees is our Bruce Allison, arborist and author of If Trees Could Talk, Stories About Wisconsin Trees. Bruce, thanks for joining us.
Well, Veronica, great to be with you.
Well, we heard there about favorite trees, and as a guy who knows his Wisconsin trees, do you have a favorite Wisconsin tree?
You know, I've got many favorite trees. And I particularly am attracted to, as you know from the books that I write, those which are historical, which connect us within our generations to those that came before, that tell our historical stories. And it seems appropriate here on Memorial Day, which started in 1868, right after the Civil War, by the Grand Republic Army, to celebrate and decorate the graves of those who have fallen during the Civil War. We still have in Wisconsin, in Delavan, a tree that stands at the intersection of 7th and Washington Street, a tree under which the soldiers, the young boys, 17, 18, 19 years old, gathered to muster to be brought into the Army and to fight to protect the Union. Today, that particular tree, which is probably about 250 years old, remains surrounded by asphalt. And there is a small little chicken pizza place nearby. And I always hope that those young people who were 16, 17, 18, as they walk around listening to their iPods and whatever, remember that 150 years ago there were people their same age, many of whom never returned as they protected our Union. And, of course, they went off to Camp Randall, which was the site in which they were trained to go on to the fight in the South. And there was, up until 1990, a red oak there that had a large plaque beneath it that said, "Dedicated to the memory of Governor Harvey." Lewis Powell Harvey was our second Civil War governor. Of course, our first was Alexander Williams Randall, who was our sixth governor in the state of Wisconsin. And he was noted for raising and organizing volunteers to be able to fight in the war. Harvey, shortly after he became governor, it was April that the Battle of Shiloh took place. He had a great compassion for those Wisconsin soldiers who were lost and injured in that war. So he took a long, long journey down to Tennessee, where the battle had occurred, to look at the soldiers and give them comfort in their makeshift hospitals. Unfortunately, as he was crossing the Tennessee River, he fell off the barge. His body was found 60 miles downstream. And you think that's the end of the story, but it's not. His widow, Cordelia Harvey, carried on his compassion for those soldiers. Carl Sandburg, in his famous biography of Lincoln, writes about her. In fact, he spends more pages on Cordelia Harvey than any other person in that particular book. Cordelia Harvey went to the generals and said, you know, what can we do for these soldiers? She was appointed to sanitary agent to the Union Army, which, of course, was just a way to keep her quiet. You have to remember, at that time, women had no position in the military. Women had very few property rights, and women couldn't even vote. But that didn't hold her back when she recognized how important it was for those soldiers to perhaps come back to the North to be cared for after they were wounded. She went directly to Washington, D.C. She spoke to Abraham Lincoln, argued with him day after day after day, till he finally relented, and the first Civil War hospital was built in Madison, Wisconsin. As a result, Cordelia Harvey was called the Octagonal House, and it made a huge difference in the many people surviving that particular war. And appropriately, after the war, it was turned into an orphanage for those people, those young people that were lost in the war.
Right, she has quite a history in Wisconsin. And talking about trees as memorials, there is a famous tree in Grand County, the Grand County Sycamore, that's a memorial.
Exactly, and that's on Sycamore Crest Farm and Sycamore Road. Early settler by the name of Joseph Crane Orr got that terrible letter from the Department of Defense at that time. Of course, it was called the Department of War, that your son has been injured. He's down in a hospital in Tennessee. Please come and tend to him. Well, he got down there, fortunately, just in time for his son to die in his arms. He brought his son's coffin back to the farm, had a cemetery nearby, and planted a tree, a sycamore tree, as a memorial to his son. And, of course, it's very common for trees to be planted at the time of birth, at the time of death, to commemorate important things. This tree still remains a very important tree. And it seems appropriate when we're talking about John Muir earlier. One of my favorite stories is the John Muir Black Locust, which was right in front of North Hall on campus. Muir came to our campus as a 19-year-old engineering student and was asked to come outside to take a look at a tree which Griswold, who was one of his fellow students who was specializing in botany, said, "John Muir, what tree is this?" And Muir said, "Well, I'm an engineering student. I don't really know." And Griswold said, well, take a look at the flower. What does it look like? You're a farmer. And Buhr said, well, it looks like a pea flower. And but how could that be? A pea is a small, straggly plant. This is a big, tall tree. Well, it just so happened that Griswold knew he had him then, because he talked about taxonomy, that connection between all living things, that somehow this big black locust tree is a legume just like a small, straggly pea. John Muir remembered that in his My Boyhood and Youth and went on to become a naturalist shortly thereafter. And oddly enough, when that Muir Knoll was dedicated in 1918 after Muir's death. His granddaughter came as part of that dedication, and she noted that her grandfather would always plant a black locust tree whenever he changed houses.
Wow, beautiful stories. Thank you so much for sharing them on this Memorial Day, Bruce.
Happy to be here.
We've been talking to our Bruce Allison, arborist and author of If Trees Could Talk, Stories About Wisconsin Trees.